Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting baby boomer women with professional peers. Advice you can use to be more confident in your financial future. Inspiration to take control of your personal finances. With Lynn S. Evans, Certified Financial Planner.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn S. Evans, and I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. There was a time in my life not too long ago when I believed three things about money. One, women are not supposed to talk about or be included in any conversations about money. Number two, women don't have the natural ability to understand anything about money. And three, men know best how to manage money. And those truths I made up about money guided me for years, until I realized money was not a foreign language or some other obscure academic exercise. And it was something I could not only understand, but teach to other women. Too many times I've heard stories from women who ought to know better, but didn't, until they were forced to, because of divorce, widowhood, job loss, or the approach of retirement. This podcast will add another chapter to an ongoing informative conversation about financial topics women should be more knowledgeable about. My mission is to help women reduce their financial illiteracy and develop a healthy relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is Holly Modasser. Holly is a senior vice president and a partner at Stearns Financial Group, a fee-only investment management firm with offices in Chapel Hill and Greensboro, North Carolina. She has extensive experience in the area of women and finance, helping women navigate divorce with the goal of achieving financial security. She's the author of a book, Gray Divorce, Silver Linings, A Woman's Guide to Divorce After 50. Welcome, Holly.
Thank you, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be on.
I can't wait to just get into all this good stuff, because I hate to say we're talking to the, or we're preaching to the choir, but we are. So I'm hoping that the women who listen to this get a really good sense of how important it is that they get some knowledge about money so that they can navigate through life and do so responsibly. So let's start with the book that you wrote, Gray Divorce, Silver Linings, and talk about some of the issues that you found that women are woefully ignorant about. And the first one is selecting the divorce process that best suits your needs. What do you mean by that?
Well, let me back up for a minute and just explain to your listeners that gray divorce is actually a term of art. It refers to divorce between longtime married couples, often 30 years or more, over the age of 50. And so that is not something that ever occurred in our parents' generation or our grandparents' generation. It's kind of a new phenomenon. And the shocking thing is that two-thirds of the time it's being initiated by the woman, and that it's growing at double the general divorce rate in this country. So it literally is sort of an epidemic.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yes. I think it boils down to what I've seen so many times with clients that start as couples. And I don't know if you find the same experience, but you can sort of tell when things kind of drifting apart. And I, for the most part, can say, honestly, that when one of the two of them call me and say, we've decided we're getting a divorce, I'm not shocked. And yeah. It's, you know, you can just get a sense of it. But the thing that I think is fascinating about it is you can boil it all down to one question. And that is, all right, the kids are gone. You've raised the kids. You're now looking at retirement. And you look at each other across the breakfast table and say, do I want to spend the rest of my life with this person? And sometimes the answer is no. And it's not always because there's someone else in the picture. It's just an awareness that I think, especially for the women, there's an awareness that I don't need to have a partner now in my life. And I want to do a lot of things that I know that he or she would not be that interested in.
Right. And it's so, not being bound anymore by the confines of the marriage and the partner. And if, you know, the question initially arose to me, you know, why is this happening now? And why didn't it happen with our parents? And I think the big difference is longevity.
Yes.
You know, we're living about 10 years longer than we did in 1960. And we're not just living longer, but we're healthier during the time that we're alive. So, you know, if you only had a 10-year window after retirement and you spent half of that in a retirement home or in a nursing home, you know, the idea of starting over again was out of the question. But mm-hmm. now you're talking about maybe I have 20 to 25 years. And I'm going to be healthy most of that time. And do I really want to spend those precious last few years in this situation with this person?
And
I think, unfortunately, the answer is often not really. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just seeing it every day. In fact, I have an entire practice devoted to this. And one after another, women coming in who are seeking a divorce.
Tell us about the process.
Well, so as you alluded, you have to select a divorce process, and most people don't know what that means because they assume that the only process is adversarial. You go get the best attorney in town. The attorney's a shark. He's going to take him for everything he's worth. But that's not the only process. You know, that's very litigious, and it's a zero-sum game. You know, I win, you lose, or you win, I lose. And instead, we have two other options. One is mediation, and I'm sure most of your listeners know what mediation is, but you have sort of this attorney in between you, and you might sit down at a table, just the three of you, and kind of hash out a deal together financially. I've seen that go awry more often than I would like, mainly because that mediator is by definition supposed to be objective. He can't advocate for either party. And so you guys could agree on something, you and your spouse, and even if you're not getting your fair share or you don't understand something or you're not even getting what the law would entitle you to get, you're signing a private contract with your spouse, and it may be completely disadvantageous to you. And so the remedy to that is the newer process called collaborative divorce. And that's where you each have an attorney, but you still sit down in the same room. You're not litigating. You're just trying to work out the details of your settlement, and you each have your own legal counsel present. So it's similar to mediation in that it's cooperative. It's not a zero-sum game. And what I often find with these longtime divorced couples or married couples is that neither one wants to injure the other. I mean, they've spent 30 plus years together. They still love each other. They share kids together. They just don't want to live together anymore. They don't want to be married together anymore. So I'm not convinced that litigation is the best route for people in that situation.
I agree. I think the collaborative divorce process is brilliant at this point. I mean, we just didn't have that in the past. I mean, it might have been there, but if everybody opted for that, that really heavy duty, what's the word I'm looking for? You said it before.
Litigation.
Yeah, but contentious. Contentious divorce. And it just seems to be that that's the way that everybody thinks of divorce. And sad part is that kind of divorce also ends up costing thousands and thousands of dollars that would otherwise belong in your own pocket. And people don't understand that. So a collaborative divorce makes sense.
I think it also has a long lasting impact on the adult children and whatever sense of goodwill is there between this longtime married couple can quickly become eroded when you have a litigator on the other side, you know, serving you papers and sending you threatening letters. So I would suggest that anybody in your audience who is actually considering this, and the caveat is this, you have to trust the goodwill of your partner. I mean, this is an open, transparent process. So you actually have to believe that, you know, your husband would come to the table and actually show what the marital assets are. He would not be hiding them in a Swiss bank account and so on. And unfortunately, there are situations like that. And in those cases, you do need a litigator. So I want to make sure that the viewers understand that there has to be some level of trust if you're going to do a collaborative divorce.
Yeah, you're right. Let's talk about something else. Just you mentioned here about building a divorce team. Is that what you meant by the collaborative divorce? Or are you including others?
I'm including a financial person. And the reason I'm doing that is because by the time you're, let's say, 60, 65, 70, my oldest client was 74 when she got a divorce. By the time you're in that age group, you're not talking about child custody. You're not talking about child support. The only thing you're talking about in this divorce, in a gray divorce, is money. How are you going to divide the assets? How are you going to give each person the best chance of starting over again? And it's a financial decision. And yet I find that the financial person is the last person someone thinks of. They go hire an attorney. They don't understand that they've hired a litigator, number one. And secondly, they somehow think that this attorney is going to be able to tell them how much money they need in order to support themselves for the rest of their lives. And an attorney doesn't do that. They can split assets that are there, but they can't help answer those questions. And so I find that women are very hesitant to close a deal because they don't know if it's a good deal. The husband might offer them, you know, I'll pay you this much and I'll give you the house. And the next thing you know, the husband, and this is an actual statistic, most married men who are divorced either achieve or do better than their married standard of living, while women spiral downward.
Absolutely.
And there are many reasons for that, which we can go into, but that's the primary reason I'm suggesting a financial advocate on your team if you're going through a divorce, because you need to understand what the ramifications, this short term, it takes 20 minutes to sign the document, is a lifetime decision.
Yes. Yes. Those 20 minutes are forever.
It's forever, especially when you're, you know, you're older and, you know, let's say you don't have the earnings power. And even if you did have the earnings power, you don't have the time horizon to be working 50 hours a week to make up for what you've lost. And, it, you know, so you really can't afford to make a mistake at this age. It's not like getting divorced when you're 30.
Right. Yeah. And I think that one thing you mentioned is the number one mistake that most women make when they go through divorce. I want the house. Well, they get the house because they feel that that is something that sustains good memories and a sense of security. It's my home.
And continuity.
I want it.
Right.
But
it's a disaster.
It is, because they don't understand where the money comes from in order to replace the boiler 5 years from now, or the roof, or things like this. They just don't even think along those lines.
And I think, not to mention that the husband got $500,000 of money while the woman got $500,000 of house.
Right.
And so the husband can potentially double his money in the stock market and have $1 million 10 years from now. Mm-hmm. And the woman has an asset that she's having to sink money into every day that's not paying the bills unless she sells it.
That's right.
And then she's got to pay the realtor's fees and she's got to update it and upkeep it. So it's just absolutely a losing proposition.
And let's move into this other one you talk about in your book, understanding investing and investing with confidence. Both you and I know that financial illiteracy among women, especially baby boomer women, is huge. And there's also a natural cultural resistance to having women understand money, because it's always been defaulted to the husbands or fathers or some male figure. So
yeah, absolutely.
Now they've got a chunk of money.
Yeah. So I read an interesting statistic the other day as I'm researching for another project I'm working on. But if a woman receives $1,000 and a man receives $1,000, the man is 30% more likely to invest it. So we all understand the power of inflation. I don't know about you, but when I was in high school, my parents bought their first house for $27,000, and now I can't even buy a car for that price.
Right.
So prices go up over time. And so if a woman gets money from a settlement, let's say she got the $500,000 instead of the house, but she's afraid of the stock market. She's not going to invest it. She puts it in her bank account. In this interest rate environment, she's literally earning zero. She's lucky if she earns 1%.
Less than zero.
Less than zero. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, at least we're not in negative interest rate territory like the rest of the world, but we're close. And so, let's say that every year the average rate of inflation is 3%. So in that time period, 10, 20 years down the road, she has actually eroded her purchasing power. It might still look like $500,000, but now the house that she could have bought for $500,000 probably cost $750,000.
Mm-hmm.
So she can't buy as much with it. Which is one of the reasons why men do better following a divorce than women, because women are more reluctant to invest their assets. And you know this as well as I do, Lynn. I mean, the stock market has been the greatest generator of wealth in the United States.
Yep.
You know, people have to invest in order to keep up with inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, studies show that women are actually better investors.
Yes.
You know, on average, when they do invest, they make like 1% or 1.5% more than their male counterparts because, ironically, they're less emotional.
Can you imagine?
No. Well, the men get, they buy a hot stock tip and then they get angry and they dump the stock and then they trade frequently and it's almost like gambling. And so they erode their returns. But women invest. And they invest for security, not returns. And so they have a long view, which is exactly what you need to be a successful investor.
Agreed. And let's talk about investing in it from another perspective. You and I had a conversation before we started recording this about what you alluded to was your next book. And there is a very strong undercurrent, let's call it that right now, of women recognizing that they can invest money not only for returns, but for other reasons. And I'd like you to talk about what those other reasons are.
Well, I'm so glad that you teed that up because I'm actually working on a book, as you allude, on values-based investing. And I did a survey of over 500 women from around the country that were 55 and older, so boomer women, and ask them, how much wealth do you think that women control in the United States? And the answer was somewhere around 36%. But the real answer is that women control as much as 60% of the nation's wealth today. We actually control the majority of the wealth in this country, but no one knows it. And so my brain immediately lit up, you know, well, you know, if you live in a capitalist society and you have wealth, that equals power. So what can women do with this wealth? Well, we don't want to give it away, all of it, because we have to be able to take care of ourselves. And you know, most women report, less than 30% of women reported being satisfied that either the government or philanthropy could solve our social problems. However, almost 70% of people thought that companies, public companies, can help solve social problems. And an example would be when Dick's Sporting Goods changed their gun laws because of public outrage and people not wanting to shop at Dick's. So, you know, if you pair economic power with a goal, you can actually change behavior. And so this book is about how women can use their wealth to vote with their pocketbooks every day in alignment with their own values.
Gee, that sounds like power of the purse.
Well, the top things that women care. Yeah, yes. Go ahead.
But you've got another, the name of your book, this one that's coming out in the spring, is called?
Women on Top, Women, Wealth, and Social Change.
Beautiful.
Don't laugh, Lynn.
I'm not. Thank you. Thank you for queuing that one up for me, too.
All I'm saying is this is an area in a world where women are not presidents of the United States. They're not CEOs of companies. Less than 6% of CEOs of public companies are women, where there's still a wage gap, where there's so much inequality. Women, this is an area that women currently are already on top. We do control the vast majority of wealth. And I think it's a window of time when women can use their wealth to actually create systemic change, like gender parity in the boardroom, closing the income gap. I mean, we can actually do that if we would work together.
Mm-hmm. Holly, I'm thinking of something that has always intrigued me when I hear that statistic. And I don't know that you may have an answer to this, but maybe when you said you did some research, you might have come up with this, but excuse me, the statement that we control 51 or 60% of the nation's wealth. My question is that in name only, or is it actually something that we have some say in?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. So the way that the that statistic was gathered was women whose accounts are $500,000 or higher, and it's titled in their name alone. Now, with that said, if you're a married woman, and I have many married women as clients, I find that often they defer to their male counterparts, so their partners, husbands, to make all the investment decisions.
Yeah.
And so this is an area that if you're not single, my encouragement would be get involved. These assets are most likely you're going to inherit these because most women outlive their spouses. Yeah. And you actually do have a say in how the assets are invested, and do your education and own it, so to speak.
What kind of investments would you say are those that are socially responsible? Do you have some names?
Well, I think that that's a loaded question. There are a lot of firms out there, the big ETF funds that say they have, you know, socially responsible investing, or they have values-based investing. But really, if you look under the hood, the fund manager is not engaging with the companies. And so anytime you sell shares of something, let's say you hate, you know, the fossil fuel industry, and you decide you're going to dump all of your Exxon stock. Mm-hmm. By definition, someone else is buying that stock.
Yes.
The company has no idea whether you were rebalancing your portfolio or whether this was an act of defiance. Mm-hmm. And you now have lost any say-so in what the company does, because you don't own anything related to them. So I think sometimes the hold and influence strategy can work better, where you actually hold the investments of companies that you want to change their behavior, and you find an active fund manager who will pool you with other people, and you will write a corporate resolution, and then everyone will vote on it. And I have in my new book examples where big change has occurred as a result of shareholder activism. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably a better strategy for some issues than divesting.
Yeah.
You know, a good example would be if you want gender equality on corporate boards, or you're trying to close the pay gap. So if you have a shareholder resolution that has to be put out for proxy vote among all shareholders, something like 80% of those are resolved before they even get out for vote. The company doesn't want that to happen. So you really wield a lot of power by holding the security of a company as opposed to selling it.
That's great advice. I don't think too many people know that. That's all good. Okay, so your book is coming out in the spring.
Yes, hopefully by the end of the first quarter. So hopefully by March 31st, we will have that book out.
And then, of course, when that happens, you'll have to come back on the podcast and talk about that more. Okay.
Well, I would love to do that, Lynn.
Okay.
Thank you so much. I hope this was helpful to your listeners.
It is. It is. Now, let me switch this around because I want to do this part that I love to do. And that's the interview questions that I sent you in advance that give everybody a little idea about your background, your experience with money, and how it informed who you became as an adult. So let's start with, what was your family like when you were growing up?
Gosh, this really is a loaded question, Lynn, because I was an immigrant with my family from Iran, and we immigrated in 1969, mm-hmm. and we had enormous amounts of wealth when we lived in Iran, but then we landed in New York City, and my parents had two kids and $5,000 and no connections.
Wow.
So it literally was the American dream to, mm-hmm. to land here with virtually nothing. I think we spent $3,800 on the first day on a car.
Okay. That
yeah.
left you $1,200 bucks. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So we bought a green Firebird with a black vinyl roof and it had bucket seats. And my sister and I crawled in the back seat and we got on I-95 and we drove directly to North Carolina because my dad was a textiles engineer.
Uh-huh.
And this was the textile capital of the world.
Yeah.
And that's where it all started.
Wow.
And so my experience with money is that I think you really have to just do the right thing. Money cannot be the motivator. Money is a means to an end. And so for me and my family, my dad felt strongly that he didn't want to raise his girls in Iran. And so literally, we gave up status and all worldly possessions and landed here, you know, going from the upper echelons of one society into the lower dregs of another. And yet we were able to work hard and survive and succeed. And so I'm not saying that you shouldn't be prudent with money, because I absolutely think you should, but I think you should always follow your dreams first.
Good advice. And was your mom someone who worked outside the home?
Oh, she was. She was a dynamo. She is a dynamo. She had her own company. It was a manufacturing firm, and they made uniforms for big box stores like Waffle House and Western Steer and Big Lots. And so she had her company, and my dad worked in textiles, and they sent us through school and then through college. And now my little daughter just graduated from Columbia. So if
Yay.
That's not the American dream, I don't know what is.
That's wonderful. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
So what's been the most threatening to your financial security?
Clearly the divorce. So I was divorced. I was 47 at the time. I had a 17-year-old and a 12-year-old. And while I did get alimony, you know, 47 is pretty young and alimony doesn't last forever. So you mm-hmm. really need a nest egg. I feel very fortunate that I was able to kind of rebuild a career and that I have this passion to help other women in that situation. Because really, unless you've been there, you don't get it.
Yeah. But you started out as a CPA before you came into the financial world. Right?
I did. So I was a CPA and I worked for Pricewaterhouse in Chicago. And then I was the treasurer of a public company.
Wow.
And then one day when I had two little kids and I left a series of checks out on the counter for the carpool, the yard guy, the, every after school activity. And I
yeah.
literally the nanny, and I looked down and I thought, oh my God, I'm like paying these people to live my life for me, to like raise my children. And I just couldn't do it. And, you know, I think today, I hope it'll be better for our kids and my daughter. But that is one of the big issues that women face is we have children.
Yeah.
And until you've had a child, you don't realize that is like the number one priority. And so, you know, maybe you don't take that overseas assignment, or you don't take the executive job, or you scale back and you don't lean in to your career. And as a result, there is this wage gap.
Yeah. And we know the impact of that, because if you take time off to be a caregiver or to raise your children, you're penalized in the long run. Because
Absolutely.
Our society doesn't quite accept that that's work that needs to be compensated. So it's a tough decision. No matter which way you do it, you'll never know whether that was the right thing or the wrong thing.
It really is. I mean, I have no regrets at all about having stayed at home to raise my children, and we're so close, and I'm flying to New York to see them for Thanksgiving, and
Yay.
I'm thrilled by that. But as someone who took time off, I'm probably making less money now. My Social Security might be lower now. You know, I mean, it works if you're going to stay married, but in this day and age, given the gray divorce rate, it's difficult to count on that. I mean, as I like to say, a man is not a plan.
That's right.
and so it's very important for young women and of childbearing age, you know, keep your foot in the door, be able to reenter the workforce, see if you can figure out how to do that. And it's hard. I mean, it's very hard. So I'm not minimizing that role at all.
Well, I think at this point, we're probably going to have to call it a day here. So my thanks to my guest, Holly Madasser. And Holly, tell people how they can get in touch with you if they have additional questions.
Well, I would love to hear from you. And my email address is hmoddasser@sternsfinancial.com. Sterns is spelled Stearns.
Okay. And so to all of you in my Power of the Purse community, I hope today's podcast gave you some freedom around money and even the littlest bit of courage to know more. If so, please visit my website, lynnsevans.com, and look around. And while you're there, sign up for my newsletter and a free guide. Thanks again, Holly, for sharing your time and your knowledge. And until the next time, thanks for listening, and remember, money is not the enemy. Your ignorance of it is. Goodbye.
This has been Power of the Purse with Lynn S. Evans, Certified Financial Planner. For more information and a free copy of The 7 Myths Our Mothers Taught Us About Money, visit online at womenofsubstancellc.com. That's womenofsubstancellc.com. Be sure to subscribe for more inspiring stories and information to help you take charge of your financial future. Thanks for listening.